From the Marquee Media Studio inside Mark Tank, it's the Mark Haney Show.
Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show. Super excited today to bringing on Greg Aguirre. He has been on the show before. He is a commercial realtor. He is the president and CEO of Capital Rivers Commercial. And he's really a member of what I call the growing economic presence that the Sacramento is. And, you know, here on the show, we're always trying to build the backyard advantage, the most connected community in the world for local entrepreneurs. And Greg is definitely an entrepreneur, but he's in commercial real estate. So today we're going to get to know his entrepreneurial journey. But also, I think for a lot of us, we're curious as to what the market looks like today in commercial real estate. So we'll have a chance to do a little bit of both. So welcome to the show, Greg.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm super excited to be here.
You betcha. Well, yeah, we ran into each other at a five-star bank event.
That's right.
Yeah. A little while ago, 25th anniversary
celebration.
Yeah. So congratulations to Five Star Bank for 25 years. They've become one of Sacramento's few public companies, and obviously they're
great
a tremendous bank.
And we bank with them, and they've helped us out. So,
oh, very cool. Same with us, and a lot of my friends as well. So, but today we're here to talk about use primarily, and your journey. Why don't we get just a little bit of your background, your journey into commercial real estate and entrepreneurships, more specifically.
Yeah, sure. I know I don't want to be sensitive to the time, but I'll kind of go back. I always been intrigued by, you know, owning a business, being an entrepreneur. Didn't come from an entrepreneurial family, though. My mom was a ballet teacher, kind of struggled when I was growing up, and parents divorced early on. Dad worked for Army Corps of Engineers. So not super entrepreneurial, and then kind of my extended family saying they always worked for somebody. And I always just had this desire to create something. I was creative, like to build things, you know, kind of the first business, I guess, if you could even call it that, was I started kind of a handyman business when I was in junior high.
Oh, wow. Because
my dad was my dad was really handy and kind of taught me, you know, how to do.
So in junior high, what kind of things did you do? I mean, most of us would be paper route or pushing a lawnmower.
Yeah, no, I was like, would change out plumbing in a bathroom. I ran a power line to an outdoor light in a neighbor's yard.
And oh my goodness.
So, like, I mean, Dad would step in to make sure it was, being done properly. All kinds of different things.
That's awesome.
I re-roofed my mom's house.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, she paid me for it because it was pretty tough. But
that's backbreaking work.
Yeah. So that was kind of, you know, my first, getting into being an entrepreneur, and I was kind of hooked from there. And, but then out of high school, you know, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I worked at this resort up in Oregon. It was like just a summer resort, and the owner ended up being a developer, and I kind of got to know him, and I was intrigued by, you know, what he was doing, you know, being able to put these projects together and make money, and, you know, he had a good lifestyle. So I kind of saw, you know, the
something
fancy
to look
car.
Forward or look
yeah.
Up to
yeah.
Bit.
And, you know, I did the odd jobs, like washing the car for him. And, like, you know, I dug a pond at his, you know, big house and stuff, but he was a super nice guy and started kind of showing me what he was doing. I'm like, I kind of want to do that. You know, I was intrigued by, you know, building something, but also, you know, I'm not going to lie, that the money was appealing as well. But I didn't want to live in Oregon. So I moved back to Sacramento. Decided to get my real estate license. I was going to American River College at the time, and then went over to Sac State eventually, which is where I graduated, and started selling homes for Century 21 part-time while I was going to college. Realized I didn't really like selling homes. A little bit too personal with, you know, and we don't like the color of the floor or whatever, you know. Ended up selling 4.5 acres here in Sacramento behind Zinfandel Grill to a housing developer, and I loved it. I was hooked. Like, that's what I wanted to do. So I started going to planning commission hearings, and I sent out letters to kind of all the developers that were in the Business Journal at the time. And all but only one of them responded. A guy named Fred Katz was who I still talk to today. FHK Development, great guy, and he brought me in, kind of told me what development was, and I was kind of hooked, and so ended up ultimately hanging my license with Danny Benvenuti Jr.
Okay,
Tower Development while I was in college, and he had a home building arm called Carmichael Builders, and I would go and knock on doors in neighborhoods and find these, you know, 1 acre to 5 acre kind of infill lots and convince them to sell the property. And then he would come in and buy it and, you know, build a small subdivision. And, you know, so I was sending out letters and knocking on doors and, you know, and that went pretty well. And then graduated college, decided I didn't want to continue to, I needed to go try something different. So I went and worked for Richmond American Homes on the land acquisition side. That was kind of in the 2007-ish, I think. And then the housing market, you know.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Took so a tank. So, right so I saw the writing on the wall that they were going to close the office. Mm-hmm. And so I left and went to a company called Armstrong Development and helped them grow their office here. And they were a preferred developer for CVS Pharmacy. So developed a lot of the CVS's, kind of Central Valley, Northern California, which was fantastic experience. Met a lot of people, great people, kind of got me into the retail side of the business. Then went over to, they bought Long's Drugs. So, you know, things kind of slowed down a little bit in terms of new development. So then I went over to JP Morgan Chase in their real estate team. Right when they acquired Washington Mutual from the FDIC.
Okay.
And so converted a lot of those and built new branches, converted a lot of old Blockbuster Video and Hollywood Video, mm-hmm. which video rentals is
yeah,
your...
Yeah, I know that business a little bit.
Yeah.
It didn't last forever.
your past endeavor, but yeah, so we converted a lot of those. And then banking regulations kind of slowed down and... so I went over and ran the real estate department for, you know, your good friend, Dale Carlson, yeah. Sleep Train, which phenomenal, you know, company and people. And,
yeah, that's a phenomenal entrepreneurial story.
Oh, yeah.
I know that you and he worked together for how many years?
I think it was around 4 years.
4 years. I mean, I have to imagine.
Felt like I was there longer though, yeah. just because of the culture that he created. But.
Well, I mean, yeah. When you work in an entrepreneurial company like that, obviously it was employee owned as well, but
yeah.
you have one of these iconic entrepreneurs and you have the opportunity to work, I guess, hand in hand, side by side with a man like Dale Carlson. It must have been an incredible, I guess, learning experience in so many ways, even though you're the real estate expert.
Yeah.
That guy's brilliant.
Yeah, no, it was fantastic just the way that he looks at things and the way that he, you know, values culture and the people around him. It was a really good experience. And in fact, a number of ex-Sleep Train employees now work for me.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it kind of goes full circle. You know, our in-house legal counsel, Scott, was in-house counsel at Sleep Train. We became friends but also worked together. And then as I grew the company and got busier, I'd kind of hand him some side projects and it just kind of grew. And I was like, well, hey, why don't you come on full time, you know, because you're pretty much full time anyway. And then, you know, we have Ryan Orne and Zach and Juan. I mean, they were, you know, some of them.
Were those
Ryan
part
was
of
like
Sleep
20
Train?
Years. They were, yeah, they were Sleep
okay,
Train.
I didn't
so
realize Ryan was part of Sleep Train, and then
yeah, like 20 years at Sleep Train.
I think it's amazing too how an entrepreneurial success story like Dale Carlson, it actually breeds more success. Obviously, you spun out yeah. and created Capital Rivers, which we'll get into in a second. But it's become, I mean, obviously, you have a great team and a great culture. But Hernani is an yeah. entrepreneur. He's doing his thing. And I know there's other entrepreneurial stories that have sort of spun out.
Oh, there's a ton. Yeah. That. Yeah. It's yeah. really cool.
It is cool. Okay. So you worked with Dale and then he had his, you guys had a nice exit over at Sleep Train.
Yep.
To Mattress Firm. And then you got on to start your own gig.
Yeah. I decided I didn't want to do the corporate thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I was never really a great... I could do the corporate gig, but it wasn't my passion to climb that ladder. And so it was the right opportunity when he sold, you know, the company to go try something out on my own. So I decided I would do, I'd be a developer, which is kind of tough out of the gate, you know. I didn't have, you know, the capital.
It takes capital.
Which I certainly didn't have, and my family doesn't have that. So essentially I got kind of sweat equity. So I had a good friend who's was a developer, and his dad's a developer, and said, "Hey, you can go do this. Let's go find some projects, and we'll kind of back you." You know, so first project was actually here in Sacramento, across from How About Arden. The team kind of jokes because I bring this up. It's the Buffalo Wild Wings Chili's story. Mm-hmm. So every time I mention it, they're like, "Don't talk about the Buffalo Wild Wings Chili's story." So we bought that center, tore it down, did some ground leases, sold those off, and so that was kind of what really kickstarted things. And then I got a percentage of the profit on the exit when we sold, but I didn't have to guarantee any debt or anything like that. And then, you know, rolled that into another deal, CVS, a pharmacy in Merced, and a Starbucks. And there's a whole story. Even all these projects are kind of like their own business venture, and there's a story behind each one, and challenges and stuff that you've got to work through. But we did the CVS and Starbucks. That was a great deal. Same structure, sweat equity. And then kind of took that money, did a Popeyes with a partner, sold that. And then went and got a loan from U.S. Bank, put it all on the line, and did a Dollar Tree in Marysville. There's a whole story behind that with the dam. I don't know if you remember the Orville Dam that was going to burst at some point.
That's right, yes.
So I was like in escrow, ready to close and, you know, get my money back. And then everything shuts down. The recorder's office shuts down.
Oh, no.
We're in the flood, you know, area, but we don't have flood insurance because we didn't need flood insurance. So I was just, you know, crossing my fingers, and luckily it all worked out, and the recorder's office opened back up, recorded, took the money and moved on. But it's just kind of built from there. And, it's been a great journey, and, we're just getting started.
Let's talk about Capital Rivers. It sounds like you have a great team. I always believe that every winning story somewhere in there, and you're a scrappy guy, has a situation where we've created a competitive advantage for ourselves. Capital Rivers have an advantage?
We do, yeah. You know, I thought long and hard about this before coming here, and actually talked to the team. We have a Friday meeting, and said, "Hey guys, I'm going to be on, you know, Mark's show. I think I know what our competitive advantage is, but, you know, help me explain it, because you're living it too, right?" And you know, I think our competitive advantage is that we as a team have built a really good culture, you know, where we care about each other, and we're really creative. So, you know, my personal, I guess, kind of competitive advantage, I would say, is I don't give up. You know, it's giving up's not an option. And I have the ability to kind of look at something and figure out how can I structure it in a way that it can be successful, or how can I overcome this obstacle maybe in a way that others haven't thought of? And that's, I think, helps us kind of grow the company, but also, be successful in some of the development projects that we take on, or new, you know, endeavors that we take on. And then having the team that supports you in that and isn't afraid to step in and say, "Hey, you know, what if you do it this way? Or, you know, I don't think that might be the best way to do it. You know, maybe we should explore some different options." And, you know, one of my kind of rules in the office is if you see a better way of doing something, or you have an idea, it's your obligation to say something. You have to say something. If you don't say something, I'm going to be pretty upset. Now, it doesn't mean that we're automatically going to do it, but, you know, everyone's got a voice and has their own experiences and background that they bring to the table, and we can learn from that and do things better. And so I guess that would be our, I'd kind of at our secret sauce, I guess.
I think that makes a big difference. I dealt with real estate a little bit. In fact, you've helped me. You and Ryan have helped me with one of my buildings.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that way for us, but I've seen this with my daughter and even selling companies. She's kind of like a deal junkie, if you will. In other words, you get a fish on, or two people have come together. You don't want it to break down like the Orville, like your Orville story. Is like you really got to hold these things together through, you know, home inspections, or you know, people getting cold feet, or trying to renegotiate in the middle of a transaction. These kind of things happen. And in commercial real estate, even more specifically, the transactions can be bigger than in residential many times.
A lot more complex.
Yeah. And so, and these people are looking at this thing maybe with less emotion. And so there's can be a lot of financial numbers and getting the banks and everybody to sort of agree to how it's going to go down. But I use the term deal junkie because you get caught up in that deal, and whether it be midnight, 2 a.m, whatever, Christmas Day, if the deal's going down, you have to live that deal and make it happen because there's so much riding on it.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's an addiction. You've got to love the business. It drives my wife nuts, but you know, I think it took 10 years of our relationship to finally get her to kind of realize, like, you know, this is just the way that it is. This is the business that I'm in, that I'm always thinking of, the next idea, or how am I going to overcome that challenge in order to get that deal to close, or, you know, there's always something, right? And particularly in commercial real estate, you know, and there's a lot of variances, right? Whether you're talking about ground up construction, or you're talking about just brokering a net lease deal, or you're talking about leasing a space, there's always complexities, and there's always challenges that come up, and there's always deadlines, and there's, you know, a lot at stake. You know, some of the transactions can be pretty significant in size. You know, so it's, you know, being organized, but also being able to, you know, address that challenge and have the resources available in order to address that challenge to meet the client's, you know, needs and expectations and not let them down. Mm-hmm. You know, particularly like if it's a 1031 exchange, there's timing, you know, deadlines you've got to meet. And if you don't meet them, they could be pretty, you know, catastrophic tax consequences. Mm-hmm. And so there's always a lot of moving parts and, you know, things going on. And but that's also what I love about it, too.
Yeah, you have to be really organized because everybody's, people are counting on you in a big way on very important transactions. Okay, so tell me about the company a little bit. You've got a great culture. How many teammates do you have, and, you know, what's the vision for the company?
Yeah, so started as a development company, and then a couple of years into that, continued to grow that. Took on Quick Quack Car Wash as a client, which we still represent them today. Nice. And they're fantastic.
That's
got to
be a great client.
Yeah, and great, you know, local story too, right?
Yes.
You know, out of Roseville, huge success.
Jason was on the show maybe 5-10 years ago. A while ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah, Jason's great, and the whole team there. And so we started to grow the brokerage division. You know, Ryan was kind of one of the first ones on board, and we, you know, added some more teammates, and the brokerage division's really kind of taken off over the last, call it, 8 years. And then we added property management as we started to do some more development and hold on to some assets, and also third-party management for other folks.
I assume Quick Quack, that's got to be a lot of development, right? They're going out and looking for new locations, so you're not buying a, you know, a car wash that's already existing. You're buying something and turning it into a car wash.
Yeah, so we only do brokerage for them.
Okay.
So we draw a pretty clear line between the development side and the brokerage side.
Okay.
So for Quick Quack, we just do brokerage, but yeah, it is. I mean, it's a long process. We got to go find a vacant lot or something we can tear down, and go through the entitlements and permits, and you know, it's a year and a half, 2 year. You know, in some cases, I think we started a deal 5 years ago and we just got a commission check on it. So,
wow.
Yeah. I mean,
it can take a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not, you know, like kind of a residential transaction where, you know, 30 days later or so you get a commission. It's, some of these can take a really long time, but, fantastic client. We grew the brokerage division. We grew property management, continued to do more development. Now we've got 25 people, including myself. Our main office is here in Sacramento at 18th and Q downtown. We bought that building, and then we have a small office in Chico, and then we have an office in Redding. So we acquired Heydrich & Co., which was a kind of well-respected boutique brokerage company up in Redding that's been around since, I think, 1984 is when their dad started it, Bill Heydrich. So they've now come into the fold. And
how important is having these offices or having an office in business? Because we're, do people come into your office and meet? Is that a thing anymore?
It is a thing, not as prevalent, obviously, as it used to be. I think the benefit of an office, particularly in what we do, commercial real estate, we're in a knowledge business. Is having everyone there and the ability, you know, the teammates there, mm-hmm. and the ability to bounce ideas off of each other. If somebody's got a question or needs help, you know, the ability to kind of jump in. So that creative environment is key. And I think that's also key to our culture and some of our successes. And it's a lot harder to do that remotely. You know, you're calling mm-hmm. each other, you miss the call, you're trying to connect. So people come into the office, not necessarily because I'm like require it, you know, with brokers, they're 1099. So I legally can't even require them to come in. They come in because they want to be in, because the environment helps them be more productive and it's enjoyable. Mm-hmm. You know, we enjoy being around each other, which is one of the reasons I left corporate real estate, is I wanted to create an environment that I actually wanted to go to and where I, you know, got energy and, you know, felt motivated. And, you know, so and it's not perfect by any means, right? Nothing is, but I think it's critical mm-hmm. To go into the office, particularly in what we do.
Well, you've been growing and you've been recognized. I know in the Business Journal, I've seen different things on you guys on Capital Rivers. What's the plan for the future? Continued growth?
Continued growth for sure. Yeah. You know, I feel like over the last 10 years, have really established a solid base. You know, people know our name, they know what we're capable of, whether it's brokerage on the development side, property management. Oh, and we just started a, economic development consulting division. So a guy named Matt Tate, who I've known for a while. We connected, hit it off. Great guy.
It's called Economic Development Consulting?
Yeah. So it's called Capital Rivers Connect.
Okay.
And what we do is we work with cities and counties and their economic development, you know, manager or team, and help them with their strategy to bring in retailers and industry and, you know, consult.
So, okay.
Particularly That's with, cool. You know, cities and municipalities of all sizes, but, you know, a lot of the smaller to medium cities, there might be one economic development person, and they're not experts in all things. And so, you know, real estate is pretty important to the growth of a community when it comes to jobs and tax dollars. And so Matt's been doing it for 20 years and has a lot of connections and a lot of knowledge. And so we felt it was a good fit, and it's been kind of taken off. So
that's great. That's great. Well, let's talk about this a little bit then. Okay, so one of the old adages in real estate is that the three most important things are location, location, location.
Yeah.
And I think about Sacramento as compared to the rest of the country in terms of location. How do we stack up in terms of location in Sacramento? Because there's so many important aspects to where to locate.
Yeah. I think Sacramento is very well located. You know, it was kind of the forgotten child a little bit to the Bay Area. You know, everyone wanted to be, you know, the new tech companies and everything were going to the Bay Area or SoCal. You know, Sacramento is so well located with the freeway systems. You know, we've got, you know, now with, you know, the Golden One, you know, arena downtown, a lot of new development happening with the rail yards. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just well located for kind of everything, right? You're seeing, you know, some tech companies start to come
you
out
bet.
This way, right?
You bet.
And they didn't do that previously. But, you know, they've got more opportunities, resources available, rent's cheaper. You know, there's a lot of reasons to be here. You've got biotech companies that are coming out of the Bay and going up into, you know, Rancho Cordova and some of those areas, you know, because they can find the space and the economics work and the quality of living for their employees, you know, is good. It's still more affordable. So, you know, I think the time is now for Sacramento, and maybe it has been for a few years, but it's continuing to grow and develop. And, you know, it's a great, great physical location.
Yeah. You mentioned the rail yard. So obviously that's a large infill area in Sacramento that's, you know, adjacent to the downtown area. That's got so much potential. What's the state of that right now? Are you involved in any development that's going on there? I know there's a soccer stadium going in on one end. There's a Kaiser at the other. And then a lot of
state
other
office
stuff.
Building.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're not involved in that project. But, you know, track it, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it's close to our office. And it's an important project for the greater Sacramento area. You know, it's changed hands a number of times. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know Kevin Nagel's been working with, you know, FC Republic and getting that going. And there's been some transitions recently with that. And but it's now coming out of the ground, which is exciting because it's been decades in the works. You know,
it's exciting.
There was some contamination issues with the land. I mean, it's been an ongoing thing, and a lot of people involved. And it's going to be a game changer, I think, for the downtown region and for Sacramento as a whole. I mean, it all expands up even into, you know, Roseville, Rockland, because people are going to come down there and hang out and go to events and things like that. So
what part of Sacramento are you finding is like the hottest spot? So I mentioned the rail yards. What I've seen, especially in the pandemic, is people migrating to the suburbs a lot, you know, Folsom, I'll call that a suburb, and Roseville and Rockland, they've done really well. Eldorado Hills has done well. You know, stuff on the outskirts.
Yeah.
Is that similar? So I've seen that in residential. Would you say that that's the truth or the same in terms of commercial?
To some extent, yeah. I mean, I think you have to kind of dig a little bit deeper into the various sectors, whether you're talking retail or industrial or multifamily. But for the most part, I would say, yeah, that's correct. You know, the newer product is going to be in the suburbs where there's land, you know, where it could have been developed. You know, the newer industrial with the higher, you know, clear heights and power, you know, are going to be in, you know, the more developed kind of newer areas, you know, Rockland, Rancho Cordova, you know, those types of areas. You know, retail, the newer centers tend to be more in the suburbs. That's where they've been built. You know, retail downtown's still kind of struggling a little bit.
Well, maybe we can walk through each of these sectors just briefly to kind of talk about the health of each sector and the factors associated with where we're at on each sector. Not necessarily by geography in Sacramento specifically, but by just, you know, the nature of retail.
Yeah.
You know, you have, let's talk retail for a second. Online retailers, you know, jumping in and swallowing up share of the market, but yet they're still brick and mortar that are still strong. But yet I see like these Rite Aids are maybe struggling. Rite Aids or some of these, you know, strip mall type of places might be struggling a little more. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah. So this is an interesting topic. You know, there was these articles kind of going back, I don't remember how many years, of like the retail apocalypse, right? Like Amazon and the internet's going to kill brick and mortar, which I always thought was silly because people were you know, we want to be around other people. Yeah. We want to interact.
We like that experience.
We like the experience, right? Like we're not going to just sit in our living room and like have everything show up. Like we want to get out and talk to people. And so like most things in life, it like got blown out of proportion and reality is probably somewhere in the middle. And that's still the case. You know, you see, you know, it's kind of got to be this omni-channel, you know, strategy or structure. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the retailers that didn't really evolve, you know, COVID kind of pushed them out quicker. And they probably should have closed anyway. You know, I mean, I love Toys R Us, but like, when's the last time that Toys R Us kind of like rethought their strategy, you know, or, you know, Sears, right? I mean, some of these should have just gone away a long time ago. Or, you know, Rite Aid, this is Kmart, like their, you know, multiple bankruptcies. Yeah, Kmart. I mean, so it's just the, I call it the evolution of retail. It's like, if you don't evolve and you don't modernize and you don't, you know, kind of be relevant, you're eventually going to go away anyway. And I think it's just easy to blame it on, you know, online retailers or, you know, online, you know, pharmacy, you know, businesses, you know, and, you know, to some extent that plays into it. But it's also likely that they just didn't really evolve. I mean, Barnes & Noble is a great example. Like, my family, we go to the Barnes & Noble in the Palladio, and they have a restaurant in there that's great. But they still sell books.
Right, yeah, it's a bookstore, right? Yeah. Amazon's, you know, obviously got into that business first.
So they kind of push towards the experience side of it, right? Like, bringing people in for the experience and shifted their model a little bit. So, retail is always going to be around. I don't think it's going to go away. It just, it evolves and changes. You know, you're seeing a lot more experiential retail now with pickleball courts and, you know, all these different concepts. You know, retail, especially in Sacramento, is still very, very strong. Vacancy rates are low. Rents are still high. You know, there might be some pause, you know, because of what's going on, you know, in the kind of political and global, you know, economy right now. But, you know, we're still busy and retail's still doing really well.
Okay, let's talk about industrial.
Yeah.
What's the state of industrial today and how's Sacramento look?
Yeah, Sacramento's industrial market has just taken off over the last, you know, call it 10 years, right? I would say it's softened a little bit. Particularly with the really large industrial distribution centers, you know, 100,000 plus square feet. You know, Amazon was kind of starting to scale back and close some locations. The smaller, you know, industrial spaces are still, they're a hot commodity. They move quickly. You know, businesses are still growing or opening and expanding. So there's still a lot of demand for that, you know, and I think there's room for continued growth of industrial, and particularly in that kind of medium to smaller size range. There's a little bit of a shortage of kind of newer retail in that square footage range, you know, where you're looking for taller clear heights and, you know, more power requirements. You know, kind of everyone wants more power now, right? Because you know, businesses are, you know, they've got more power demands, you know, like data centers is a hot topic, but you can't find, you know, there's very few locations that have enough electricity to service those data centers. So it's evolving too, right? It goes and changes. You know, there's a lot of hydrogen production companies looking in the region, you know, which kind of helps fuel some of that growth. So still strong. Not going away.
What about, say, that's where typically like manufacturing is going to end up in one of these industrial buildings. Is that right? And we don't have a lot of manufacturing here.
We don't. Yeah, not really. We could use more. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and there's, you know, a lot of companies want to be in Roseville, Rockland. Well, there's just not space available. Okay. You know, so we need more industrial. But I think, you know, developers are kind of looking at like, what's the right size now, you know, and how do we develop that out, you know?
What about office? Obviously, people during COVID, we all, you know, a lot of people started working remote. And now there's some requirements to start coming back to work. So I know the office market was softer by a lot.
Yeah.
Maybe we had way too much office. Where are we at today?
Yeah, office is still still in a tough spot. You know, I talk to people and the conversation's like, well, what is the solution for these high-rise office buildings? And, you know, I think everyone kind of thinks, oh, well, you can just convert it into residential, right? Easier said than done. Most of them don't work for that, and it's cheaper to just tear it down and build a, you know, new residential tower. You know, there's obviously been some cases where it has worked and some pretty cool projects. But for the most part, economically, it just doesn't make sense. So the large, you know, office towers, I don't think anyone really knows what the answer is yet or the solution. You know, there's been some investors and developers that have been taking a chance that is going to come back, you know, and they're able to pick up these, you know, these office products for pennies on the dollar. You know, they're just willing to carry it until, you know, something happens, mm-hmm. you know. But the smaller office products, still a lot of demand, you know. Businesses still need to continue to run, you know, downtown, you know, for kind of the smaller, you know, call it 10,000 square feet or less. There's still a bunch of demand for it. Same with in the suburbs, you know, as you kind of branch out from downtown. And I'd say that holds true kind of for the product category as a whole.
Okay.
So
what about multifamily? You guys don't do as much on that.
We don't. Yeah.
What is the state of multifamily though today? Is it, is there enough, multifamily homes?
Yeah, it's certainly not our area of expertise, but you know, from the folks that I know and the research that we do, you know, multifamily slowed down a little bit because of the interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was quite a bit of new, you know, multifamily product that was put on the market, and you know, supply and demand issue, right? So as you know, interest rates go up, it makes it harder to develop more multifamily.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing too, because if interest rates go up, you know, housing's less affordable, like if you want to get into your new house, but yet if we don't have enough homes altogether, or maybe we need to build some more multifamily, interest rates are high and we're not developing because, you know, it doesn't pencil to build a place. It seems to me that it would put pressure on rents, but I haven't really seen that. I have rental properties and stuff like that. And it doesn't seem like it's put a lot of pressure on rents going up.
I mean, I think people can only pay so much, right? Mm-hmm. Like at some point, you know, you're going to push people out of the market and then they're going to have to just commute further, right?
Right.
So you can't just, you know, continue to push without, you know, there being some other factor at play, like, you know, they're making more money in order to justify that. I think you're seeing, you know, older multifamily product being acquired and, you know, renovated. So that's kind of pushing that, you know, where you can have the rents be a little bit lower, but you can add some value to the asset and, you know, get a return there that makes sense. You know, multifamily is always going to be in demand. People always need a place to live. There's some people that'll never own a house, don't want to own a house. You know, so it's fine. Nothing's going, you know, nothing bad is happening with multifamily. It's just not as fast of growth, you know, as it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah. Okay. So we only have a few minutes left, but what factors, you mentioned interest rate, you mentioned a little bit about uncertainty with, you know, new administration and, you know, all the potential changes that could be happening from a geopolitical standpoint. Taxes obviously are a factor. We're trying to get a tax bill across. What factors right now are affecting people's decision on, do I go now or do I put off the decision?
All of those things.
Okay. Yeah. A little bit of everything.
Yeah. It's hard to say, because I think the biggest issue is just the unknown.
Mm.
You know, the markets don't like uncertainty. As a developer, we don't like uncertainty. As an investor, you don't necessarily like uncertainty. The counter argument to that, I would think, you know, at least from my perspective, is it also creates opportunity. But, you know, I would say, you know, most are looking at the market from a more, you know, security kind of standpoint, right? They're not a developer going to go take a big risk, right? So they want that market stability. And I think it's hard to say, you know, well, what were the impacts of tariffs going to have? Nobody, I don't think, really truly knows, right? And, you know, interest rates obviously have an impact, right? The cost of capital is more, you know, that makes it tougher to develop new product. It makes it tougher to go acquire an asset and have your, you know, your cash flow, or your IRR, you know, meet your thresholds. You know, and, you know, the tax plan, I'm not an expert on that, but, you know, things like bonus depreciation are certainly helpful. Mm-hmm. You know, if that, you know, I think it went back to 100% or those, the plan. And so, that would be a big win, you know, 'cause that's certainly a benefit of owning real estate is the depreciation, especially if you can accelerate it. But, you know, I think in order to, you know, we're still growing. It's kind of slow and steady. But in order to kind of get back on track, I think we just need certainty. We just need to know, have a better idea of what the future looks like. You know, I was talking with, we've got a partner up in Canada on a project that we developed in Elk Grove, a senior care facility and a dialysis clinic. And, you know, they love investing in the U.S., but they've just kind of put things on hold just to kind of see what happens. You know, I had a lender that kind of same thing. They're like, we're just not really sure where things are going to go. So, you know, check in with us every month, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the status, I think, until there's a little bit more certainty.
All right. All right. So last question, I'm just kind of thinking about how technology, we're investing into a lot of tech companies. In fact, yeah. I'm invested into one company that helps commercial real estate specifically, you know, Cretelligent.
Yeah.
Right. So
really well.
Yeah. Great.
I see
people.
The CEO at the gym.
What a great yeah. Anthony Romano. What yeah. a great guy. Anyway, so I'm wondering what technology is doing to your industry specifically, and what kind of technology are you embracing these days, and what's missing, you know, for any entrepreneur out there that's thinking, how can I create yeah. a business? What's missing, but what's working?
Yeah. Commercial real estate has never been known as a tech industry. Yeah. It's always been like...
Don't tell Anthony Romano that.
I know.
He's aggregating data to help
developers. Well, it's becoming a tech business, though.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, kind of on the leading edge of that. And, you know, it's quickly evolving. You know, AI, obviously, everyone talks about mm-hmm. it, but it does make your job easier. It's like your power assistant is what kind mm-hmm. of what we call it. So, you know, if you want to, you know, review a pro forma, don't rely on it, but it's a good assistant to kind of double check your work. You know, if you want to put together some marketing materials, like it can help you kind of craft it to your audience, right? Again, don't solely rely on it, make it your own, but it's a really powerful admin. So we're using AI a lot, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's ChatGPT or Gemini, just in our daily workflows, but you know, also trying to figure out how do you automate some of the marketing activities, right? You know, using, you know, maybe it's 11 Labs and does some, you know, podcasts or something, right? Mm-hmm. It's getting really, really good and it's evolving quickly. And a lot of that technology then is being kind of bolted onto some other, you know, front end programs that are running, you know, the back of office, you know, brokerage, you know, processing of disclosures and commissions and, you know, checks and things like that, just to make the process simpler and easier, require less, you know, person power to get things done. And there's a ton of fantastic companies that are doing great things in commercial real estate involving tech. It's now kind of which ones are going to float to the surface and, you know, really be the solution, right? And so it's kind of, we're in test mode to figure out which ones are really a good fit. And it's a really exciting time. And I think, you know, particularly in commercial real estate, if you can embrace the technology, it's going to accelerate your growth. And there's some people that just aren't willing to do it, which is a great opportunity for us, right?
For sure.
So
for
please sure. don't, so that we can continue to
don't embrace it. Yeah. Words of wisdom from Greg Geary. Don't embrace technology.
Yeah, yeah. So selfishly we can and continue to grow. So yeah.
I love it.
Well, Mark, I wanted to give you these Stay Hot socks. So Ryan, who you know, he's got this saying that he said forever, stay hot, which he's kind of coined as like, good job, keep up the good work. And it's become something that we all say in the office now. Every year he creates his own socks.
Oh, let's take a look.
So here's some stay
hot socks. Oh, Ryan, I love you. I appreciate that. Stay hot. You stay hot too, Ryan. You too, Greg.
And the best part of those is if you wear those, they give you good luck and you make money.
Oh,
so
that's awesome.
When the brokers want to close deals, which should be every day, you put the socks on and magical things happen. So
I should have borrowed these last Monday on Memorial Day. I was getting ready to run the Murph, which is a CrossFit workout.
Yeah, yeah.
And I rolled my ankle going around the building. If I was wearing these socks, I wouldn't have a sprained ankle right now.
They fix everything.
Okay. Yeah. I'm wearing these. Thanks, Ryan. Well, congratulations on your success. I love that the homegrown success story out of the Sleep Train and all the opportunity that you're creating and all the investors and developers and all the people involved in real estate are lucky to have you, one of the good ones, as part of the industry. So appreciate
coming
on the
show. It's a team effort. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you. And to all you out there fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship and for the backyard advantage, and of course, all of you out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life. Here at Haney Biz, at Mark Haney Show, and the Growth Factory, we're never above you, we're never below you, always by your side.
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in this segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.